From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Syria's president used poison gas on his own people, and White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer had an unfortunate response.
We didn't use chemical weapons in World War II. You know, someone as despicable as Hitler, who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons.
Spicer apologized for that remark soon after making it this week. The break room debates the difference between an honest mistake and a fireable offense later this hour. First, construction on two nuclear reactors near Waynesboro stopped after the company behind the project filed for bankruptcy.
The important thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we should look at where are these nuclear reactors under construction and why has it been in the South?
Sue Sturgis is editorial director for Facing South magazine. Here are your first thoughts. Todd Rehm tweets, most of the population growth is in southern states, driving nuclear development here. Mary Landers replies, population growth is up, but electricity demand is flat at most. Regulated utilities have been able to shift the risk of nuclear to consumers. Well, we checked into these comparisons here in Georgia, and we found the state population is increasing. In fact, our growth rate puts us in the top 10 for U.S. states. Meanwhile, the amount of electricity sold has been comparatively static over the past decade. Electricity providers actually sold fewer megawatt hours to consumers in 2015 compared to what they did in 2007. That's according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. We always love hearing your thoughts, though. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message, or you can tweet us, like Mary and Todd did, at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Tom Price left his seat in Congress to lead the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington. There are 18 people trying to replace him. The 6th District seat has been solidly Republican for years, but there's a chance it could go to Democrat John Ossoff this time around during the special election next Tuesday. We talked about this last month with Greg Bluestein, reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and also Audrey Haynes, associate professor of political science at the University of Georgia. So, Audrey, tell us a little bit about this seat, about the 6th District, with strong roots in the Republican Party going back to Newt Gingrich. Tell us about this district.
Yeah, so in 1979, we saw the end of Democrats in that district, and Newt won. He had been pursuing that district for a while. And then afterwards, you saw basically Republicans really dominate from that time period. You had Johnny Isaacson, and Tom Price has, you know, just had a very comfortable time in the 6th District. It's a well-to-do district. It is an educated district. There's a lot of business orientation in there. And Tom Price himself is a very conservative Republican, and he has managed to win there handily over a long period of time.
And yet, Greg, you've written that this special election could be a litmus test for Trump support. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, as Professor Haynes said, Tom Price won this district with 60+% of the vote just about every time he went up for re-election. But Donald Trump only won it by 1 point. And this is a district that Mitt Romney carried 5 years ago with double digits. So this is an area that Marco Rubio won in Georgia's March presidential primary. And John Ossoff supporters and other Democrats think that it could be fertile ground for sort of a Trump backlash in April.
What do the voters think, or what are their priorities, I guess?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And it's hard to tell. I actually tried to get some data from the 6th District on some newer trends and some newer survey data, but there wasn't a lot there. So painting him as an elitist, well, it's a very educated district. Most of the people who live in the 6th District and work there are professionals. They've gone to college. A lot of them have postdoc degrees. It's highly tech-oriented. In fact, some of the Republicans who are running recognize that, and that's a part of their background.
When you say he has outside support, there was even a wine shop in Portland holding a fundraiser for Ossoff, with offering a southern feast for $60 a plate. And this is the thing that has kind of made a lot of headlines, Greg, is the amount of money Ossoff have been able to collect. The website Daily Kos raised more than $1 million for him. Why?
Yeah, and also I'll say that John Ossoff is going to be in Washington today, and he has a fundraiser with Nancy Pelosi and other top House leaders. The party has rallied around him, and the amount of money he claims to have raised, and we can't verify it yet, but he claims to raise more than $3 million is just astounding in the opening months. And he announced in January, and it's the Ides of March, and he's already raised more than $3 million for a special election that's usually seen as a shoe-in for Republicans. And that has really galvanized a lot of attention behind his campaign. I'd also add, too, that other Republicans candidates even are marveling at his ground game. I mean, he's visited, I live in the sixth, and his canvassers have visited my district now twice, my neighborhood now twice. So there's just a lot of also distraction and fractured on the Republican side, because you've got candidates who are cozying up to Donald Trump, saying that they're the number one 100% supporters of Trump, and others who are barely mentioning his name. So it's kind of a skewed field on the Republican side, and there's so many high-profile names on the Republican side, there's no one to rally around on that side yet.
And that's what makes it this race so interesting. Audrey, let me go to you, because Ossoff's, I guess, rallying cry is "Make Trump Furious." Could that play in this district that very narrowly went for Trump in the election?
Well, you know what? I think he has to be very careful, because a special election like this, there's a large element of mobilization. So, you know, the good thing is it is getting national attention, so many more people are going to know, and there's going to be more turnout. On the Democratic side, I've never seen quite so much organization. I mean, you had a lot of support for Barack Obama in 2008, and there was a novelty and great themes, but, I mean, there is so much. It's almost as if the Democratic Party woke up and said, oh, my God, if we don't do something, we're in trouble, and they're really acting on it. So, you know, he really has to play on that. But at the same time, if there are any voters, for example, some of those turnout voters, they turned out in 2012 for a Democratic candidate, but they didn't turn out in 2016. He's got to focus on them. Non-college women, that's one area of group that tends not to like Trump, but they have to be mobilized too. He's got a lot of younger people. I mean, one benefit to this district is there are a ton of young people under the age of 44, and that may help him. But he may want to be like Rob Portman and talk about issues that matter to the people in that district, because it is a congressional race. And, you know, sometimes national politics plays a role, and it may in this case, but very often congressional races are a little different.
Yeah, okay. So, Greg, let me put this to you then. If John Ossoff wins this seat, what does that mean for the Democrats? They seem to think it means a sort of a real symbolic victory against the Republican Party and Donald Trump. Are they right?
I'll preface this by saying that Republicans are still supremely confident they'll take the seat, and they think that in a runoff, that his advantages will be neutralized, because runoffs tend to be an older electorate that's more conservative. But John Ossoff I think it's safe to say he's going for the knockout punch. It's an outside shot, but he's going to go for the...
Meaning he's trying to get 51% or more.
Yep, 50% plus one in April. And there are some Republican campaigns that are beginning to get worried about that, because if Ossoff wins, it will be a national statement. This is the most competitive and one of the first special elections since Trump's victory. So it would say a lot, and that's why it's become a national story. That's why Washington Post, New York Times have all put this race on their front pages, and it's been all over the airwaves, because this is sort of a symbolic moment in the post-Trump era.
That's Greg Bluestein, reporter for the AJC. You also heard Audrey Haynes, associate professor of political science at the University of Georgia. Money is pouring into the race for Georgia's 6th district, and some of it is going toward attack ads aimed at mostly one of the 18 candidates. Last week, the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is a conservative super PAC, launched an ad linking Democrat John Ossoff to media outlet Al Jazeera and thereby to Islamic terrorism. Take a listen.
Al Jazeera, a media outlet that has been described as a mouthpiece for terrorists. has been paying John Ossoff thousands of dollars. But John refuses to tell voters exactly how much money he's received. Just like John refuses to tell voters the truth about his experience. What is he hiding? How can we trust him?
With me now to talk about these attack ads and attack ads in general is Andra Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's just set aside what was said in the attack ad, because Al Jazeera is not a mouthpiece for terrorists. It's a credible journalistic enterprise, and John Ossoff worked for Al Jazeera. That's the money, I think, that they're referring to that he received?
Well, full disclosure, I've done interviews with Al Jazeera, and I found them to be a reputable source. He did documentaries, and those documentaries were sold to Al Jazeera so that they could broadcast them, and so that's the money that he recouped.
Although this makes it sound as though they're funding his political campaign, which is not the case.
As far as I know, I have not looked at his reports, but I doubt that would be the case.
But really what's at issue here is the idea of an attack ad, which is not whether or not a political scientist and a journalist is going to believe the claims that are made. It's whether the voter, mm-hmm. who has way too many other things to do besides research this stuff, is going to believe it. So the question that we start with is, how effective are attack ads in general?
So attack ads can work in a couple of different ways. So there are a number of theories out there. One theory is that attack ads are intended to demobilize the opposition and to mobilize the base.
Get the others to not vote.
To not vote, and then to get your side to turn out to vote at higher rates. So you're giving your side a reason, fodder, to vote for your candidate and against the person who is the target of the attack.
Fear is the motivator.
So that's part of it. And, I wouldn't say necessarily that fear is the emotion that one is necessarily tapping into. I think there needs to be more research to identify that specifically. But it is this notion that it riles your side up and then it discourages the other side. Then there is another point of view which argues that negative ads are actually useful because they tend to convey more information than positive ads do, in part because they usually have to provide citations. Otherwise, PolitiFact and other news outlets will hold them accountable for it. They, provide issues about voting. They provide issues about issue stances. They provide issues about a candidate's experience. So in that respect, they're actually useful because they actually do help voters make decisions and get information that they wouldn't otherwise go out to receive. Now, the thing that you always want to take into account, to be clear, is that information accurate? And they're going to stay within the bounds. So they're not going to go out and say certain things because that would be a bridge too far, even though they're in a gray area that I think some people would find
ethically
questionable.
You mean they're not going to call John Ossoff a terrorist?
They're not going to call John Ossoff a terrorist. But by saying that he accepted money from Al Jazeera, which is true, because he did sell some documentaries to Al Jazeera, they do want to tap into notions of fear. They want to tap into this current political discussion about Islam, where people are afraid. They want to reinforce this notion that Democrats don't want to attack what they would call radical Islamic terrorism. And they are also, especially for older voters who are aware of this, they are reminding voters about the role that Al Jazeera, the Arabic version of Al Jazeera, played in terms of disseminating tapes from Osama bin Laden. And that does cause consternation amongst many voters, and that could be used to rile them up, whether out of fear or out of anger against John Ossoff.
That's Emory Professor Andra Gillespie. We'll continue our conversation on attack ads in just a few minutes, and then the break room has a lot to say about United Airlines' strong-arm tactics. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Let's get back to our conversation now with Emory University political science professor Andra Gillespie. We're talking about attack ads being used in the 6th District congressional race. Let's play another ad. And again, this is another attack ad against John Ossoff because he's the one that's the target of almost all of these ads. If I haven't seen any targeting anyone else. So here's another one. And this is actually getting him for his ties to Nancy Pelosi.
Nancy Pelosi's liberal agenda put America $20 trillion in debt, and John Ossoff is on her side. Pelosi supports higher taxes, and John Ossoff is on her side. Pelosi supported the Iranian nuclear deal that weakened our national security, and John Ossoff is on her side. On April 18th, vote Republican and say no to Pelosi's yes man.
So in this case, this is maybe tying into some. Is there evidence that maybe people in Cobb County and in the 6th District don't like Nancy Pelosi?
Well, the working assumption here, because this is a Republican-leaning district, and at best Democrats are trying to move it into becoming a swing district, that you're going to have people here who are going to be more ideologically conservative. And so even if they are, you know, willing to consider a Democratic candidate, there might be a certain type of Democratic candidate that they're not willing to consider. And so by trying to tie Ossoff to Nancy Pelosi, which would be what some people would perceive to be the very liberal left wing of the Democratic Party, I'm sure that if you were talking to people who are more, you know, in the Bernie Sanders camp,
they don't see her
as liberal. But in the minds of somebody who is moderate to conservative leaning, Nancy Pelosi is very liberal. She's from San Francisco. So this place is attached to what people see as, you know, as extreme liberalism. It actually starts to cast doubts in the minds of some of these persuadable voters that maybe Ossoff doesn't represent the values that they hold dear.
You mentioned while we were listening to that, that there is an attack ad from one Republican to another Republican. But the vast majority of them are against John Ossoff, and that's because John Ossoff is doing better than I think most people expected to do.
It's not just that. It's also that, and these are mostly coming from super PACs and from the Republican Party, they're looking ahead to the runoff election. So they assume that there's going to be a runoff election. And if they're not 100% sure that that's going to happen.
A runoff occurs if somebody doesn't get more than 50%
of the vote. And that's
right.
Likely Ossoff hasn't polled above the low to mid 40s in any public polling that's been released. And so the numbers would suggest that Ossoff wins this election, but he doesn't get 50% plus one and thus throwing it to a runoff. So the first thing that they're trying to do is they're trying to make sure that Ossoff doesn't get to 50%. So that's step one. But then step two is making sure that, presuming he gets to the runoff, that it actually demobilizes that runoff base and sort of tries to keep that number low and manageable so that whoever ends up in second place is in a good position to be able to consolidate the other vote and challenge Ossoff successfully.
Because the vast majority of these 18 candidates are Republicans, and I guess political activists are assuming that once there's not more than 10 Republicans in the race, it won't split the conservative vote, and therefore Ossoff faces a bigger challenge.
Right.
Now, Ossoff has, for the most part, ignored his Republican contenders in the 6th District, and he is running against a Republican.
But when President Trump embarrasses our country or acts recklessly, I'll hold him accountable.
To what extent is this district a philosophical and symbolic either victory or loss for the parties in terms of it being, besides Kansas, one of the very first elections that might reflect on Donald Trump?
So compared to Kansas, this one was more contested. If we look at the November election results, Tom Price won this district handily.
Tom Price, the Republican who is now part of the
administration. And his departure is the reason why we're having this special election. Donald Trump, on the other hand, barely won this district. And so because Trump barely won this district, Democrats see an opportunity to build the party. They're also
and Cobb County, which is part of the 6th District, actually went for Hillary Clinton.
So between Cobb and even though Gwinnett County is not part of this district, the fact that Gwinnett County does the same thing is also evidence of the fact that they're changing demographics in the district that suggests that this may not be safe Republican territory anymore. And so Democrats want to test this theory out by organizing as best they can in this district to not only send a signal nationally that they're prepared to compete in 2018, but to also send a message in this state that more parts of the state are going to become increasingly competitive on a partisan level.
So I want to play you this comment from Eric Love, who's a professor of sociology at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. This rings true to me only because I watched my teenage son, 18-year-old son, responding to some of the negative attack ads he's seen.
This is the sort of strategy that Americans increasingly reject. They, you know, negative campaign ads have been unpopular for a long time. And I don't think that's going to be any different in this race here in the Georgia 6th.
So my son became motivated to vote perhaps more than ever because he saw these negative campaign ads that he thought were just over the top and extreme. Is that common?
So I love Eric. He's actually a postdoc in my institute this year. But as a political scientist and as somebody who has worked in politics before, I'm going to have to disagree. And I think your son's reaction is precisely why people use negative campaigns. So, yes, people hate them, but they respond to them. And so you can hate them all you want. they appear to work, and so because they appear to work, politicians are going to keep on using them. And so the same way you point out your candidate's flaws in order to provide a contrast between you and them, the same thing also happens is you have to respond to negative campaign ads, which is what we've seen Ossoff do in terms of responding to those attack ads. You can't let them just kind of go away and assume that sticks and stones, you know, will break your bones, but words don't hurt you. At the end of the day, the accumulation of those words is an accumulation of information that could be weaponized against you, which is why you have to meet it. And also why you sometimes have to employ it in an offensive fashion.
That's Emory political science professor Andra Gillespie. Andra, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
It has been a long week. We talked about the party scene in Athens, the Satanic Temple in Atlanta, and why author Juno Diaz does not give advice. But as we do every Friday, it's time to gather a group of smart people together, kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It is time for the break room.
Well, this is pretty disgusting. A nationwide recall is in place after two Floridians found a dead bat in their salad.
We're United Airlines. You do what we say, when we say, and there won't be a problem. Capiche?
You know, you had a, you know, someone as despicable as Hitler who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons.
Joining us in the break room, Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, and filmmaker and podcast producer Kalina Baller. Welcome, everyone. You made it to Friday.
Yeah, we did.
Yes. Morning.
Morning.
Good
morning.
All right, let's see if we can get some lively discussion going here. Everybody knows you need a little time away from the office from time to time, right? Just to decompress.
I can't take it anymore!
Presidents need time away also, but some say Donald Trump is taking a little too much of it. Since taking office, he's spent more than $29 million on travel. That's more than double what President Obama spent in a year's time. So, should there be limits on a president's vacation expenses, the amount the taxpayers pay for?
I'll jump into this one first. I think the model here should be another politician who's flirted with both parties, who's won high elected office, and that's New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. I think the New York Times reported that Bloomberg spent $650 million of his own money covering travel, offering perks and benefits to his employees, et cetera. And he took $1 for his salary for the 12 years he was the mayor of New York. I think Trump...
What if you don't have $650 million?
You know, Trump says he's gotten way more than that. I would hope that in this case, for someone who has the means, that he wouldn't cost the American taxpayers. He promises to represent the kind of money
he has. Okay, but that's voluntary. I'm wondering if we should actually just put a limit on the amount that taxpayers pay for vacation travel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need to do that. I mean, you lead by example. I mean, no one ever wrote that we were supposed to endorse or support the lavish lifestyle of, you know, whatever leader we have. I mean, we live in a system of checks and balances. And in a system of checks and balances, one of the key things is that you're supposed to show you're responsible in your management of government resources, right? So, I mean, what he's doing is neither sensible nor is it an example. And on top of it, it can even range on the unethical, because in many cases, the expenses are benefiting his own companies.
Because he's going to his own resort in
Maryland. That's right. And it's more of a security risk, too. Because at this point, it's not just about the vacations and spending the money. It's a security risk at this point. Because if you keep going to your own properties that you own, you're more of a target. You and your family are more of a target. And that's a liability on the entire United States. So, yeah.
Well, it's more difficult to secure Mar-a-Lago than Camp David. That's what security experts
agreed.
Say.
Agreed. Right. So all of it is just it's a money pit, and it's a waste. It needs to go away.
I would like to see it just use some restraint. If you're going to, especially for people who campaign on, we're going to cut wasteful spending, we're going to lower the budget, we're going to repair the amount of debt that the American people are in, and you're governing people who work every weekend and you're flying off to Florida every weekend. And, you know, we look at some of the numbers. I read an article earlier this week that some of the numbers are in dispute, and they're like, well, it may not cost $3 million a trip. It may only cost $1 million a trip. We don't know for sure. I mean, oh, only $1 million.
The reason we don't know is because the White House won't release those numbers, so we have to make estimates based on previous years.
So they're basing it off an Obama trip that was maybe or maybe not similar. Regardless, if you're spending that much money, you're going on a vacation that costs what it would take a middle-class American 10, 15, 20 years to make that much
money. That makes
money.
No sense at all.
Right.
I just don't understand why his base isn't in more of an uproar about this. I just don't know why.
Alternative facts.
Oh, gosh.
that's a completely different break room topic.
Yeah, exactly.
If you go on a vacation, though, maybe you'd want to invest in a yacht.
It seems like what you guys are looking for is some sort of P. Diddy-style shrimping vessel.
This isn't Diddy-esque at all.
Guys, crazy? This boat is awesome.
The Georgia legislature passed a bill giving a tax break for yacht repairs that cost at least $500,000. Many people say that is tone deaf and a giveaway to the super rich. Defenders say it will encourage yacht repair businesses to locate in... You're laughing already, but this is a serious thing. They say yacht repair businesses will locate it in Georgia. What do we think?
Really, we're going to build an economy on yacht repair business. I mean, they don't even have that in Florida. I mean, where do they think we live? Where do they think we live? I mean, we're not in Monaco. We're not in Monte Carlo. I mean... That's really not gonna
yeah,
add much
to Atlanta.
Doesn't
have a coastline.
No, exactly.
Well, I can tell you, as probably the only regulatory affairs lobbyist around the table this morning,
more often than not,
when these deals get pushed, it's because there already is an investment that's been teed up, and that organization is typically lobbying the administration to make it happen. My understanding is that there is a $50 million investment in a yacht repair and some odd business that's supposed to come to Savannah. And I think they've specced out 800 jobs, et cetera, et cetera. I would tend to agree if there isn't something teed up for it. But my understanding is that we're losing yacht repair business to Florida. And this is just that internecine battle between states for investment, for companies, et cetera. That's just what it is. And that's what it takes when you want to be the number one city.
We're losing on a lot of industries to California.
why do we drag up $500,000 from? Okay. If we can give them, I love tax credits, tax breaks, tax repeals. Woohoo! You know,
don't you want to get rid of taxes?
Get rid of taxes. But the thing is, why 500,000? Why is that our magic number? Why not 50,000? Why not 5,000? Why not, you know, an average guy who has a sailboat that might be considered a yacht that doesn't cost 500,000 and it sure doesn't cost that much to fix it? Why would he not get a break on his repair?
Well, that really broadens the number of people that would get that tax cut.
But it would also broaden the amount of people who could afford to get their yacht repaired and therefore do business with the companies they're trying to recruit. Why make that threshold so high that it doesn't benefit the majority of the people with a boat?
I think we're missing the point around this table is that the idea of a shrimping vessel, P. Diddy-esque yacht... Who wouldn't want that? As a millennial, I am triggered.
That is from the show Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And if you've seen that episode, you know that was about the farthest thing from a yacht.
Exactly. Great episode.
Ever could have had. We only have a couple minutes left, so we might as well get started on talking about United Airlines, and we can finish up in just a moment. Hector's already ready. Go ahead, Hector.
All right. Munoz needs to be fired.
Munoz is the CEO of United
Airlines.
Yeah,
he needs to be fired. I mean, you should treat people with decency and with respect. And United has obviously reached a point where they're training the individuals not to care. His leaked memo pretty much reinforced bad behavior and said that it was all okay and according to the rules. They took quite a while to apologize. So that's a very dangerous position. That's when you know, the customers realize that a company is not caring about them, then customers stop caring about the company.
Right.
I mean, and Delta, I mean, is not as bad as United, but Delta could reach that point. I mean, last week they canceled planes, flights galore because of the storms. And it was basically because they were not organized enough. But you should have seen the airport. It was a mess. It was a mess. I mean, I was traveling with my son to see colleges on his birthday. And, you know, we were like over 4 hours in a line only to be dismissed in less than 5 minutes by a Delta employee that was extremely well-trained. And she couldn't care less. She really couldn't care less. So Delta needs to start doing something. I mean, United is a foregone conclusion. But, you know,
we only have about 30 seconds. Does anyone want to follow up here?
I've been on flights in which I've been asked to, you know, volunteer my seat. It was overbooked, blah, blah, blah. But I have never run into this sort of complete disregard, you know, for this customer. And then this was insane. And when I refused, because I said, I really need to get there, they said, okay. And they moved on to the next person. I just don't understand why that was so difficult.
Yeah, I think that's I've never seen that happen when you've actually already boarded the plane. I've seen it happen beforehand, and they offer it.
We're going to
And when I've boarded the plane, I've been on, and they say,
we'll give more details in just a moment. It is Friday. We are hanging out in the break room. Coming up, we'll continue this, but also White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer and his shocking account of the Holocaust. And what is the strangest thing you've ever found in your lunch? This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We're having coffee and conversation in the break room. My guests are filmmaker and podcast producer Kalina Baller, Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, and Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez. And we want to say a thank you, as we always do, to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that we drink. It's good coffee. They're online at savannahcoffee.com. I want to return to the question of United Airlines. This, of course, is in relation to the story of the physician that was forcibly removed from the United flight. His name is David Dow. His lawyer says he lost two front teeth. He sustained a concussion and a broken nose, and in the end will need reconstructive surgery. The video of him being dragged out of the flight with blood coming out of his mouth has gone super viral. What's after viral? So we already heard a little bit from Kalina and from Hector. Howard or Sam, you guys want to weigh in here?
I think the easiest solution to this case is customer service, which we don't get from any large businesses anymore.
That's correct.
Especially the airlines.
Hate of that.
But when you deal with numbers and you're like, you are customer 647295, then that's a whole lot different than dealing with Sam.
I think this goes well beyond customer service. I think, you know, we're in a post-smartphone society, and we would be hearing about maybe, you know, an article or two about this entire scenario if people hadn't actually whipped out their camera phones on the plane, gasping at what's actually happened, and that footage going viral. I think the police department, sheriff departments, et cetera, have had to deal with this the last number of years. Organizations that have started with an assumption of operating above board now have to know that anyone can record what you've done, and it can have disastrous implications.
Yeah, they lost more than $1 billion.
More than $1 billion in market cap. Also, don't hire nightclub bouncers for airport security.
But like, that was a police officer.
That would help.
I mean, he must be moonlighting in somebody's club. I mean, they beat this guy up in addition to dragging him out.
Okay.
And then let somebody get overbooked tonight at that Braves game for the opening of SunTrust and see how that's going to turn
right.
out.
Oh, boy.
They don't overbook ball games and concerts. Don't overbook airplanes. You got so many seats, still so many seats.
In the airline's defense, I can't believe I'm saying that, overbooking actually keeps our prices down. That's an entirely different story.
It keeps our customers down, too.
Okay, let's move on to a more disgusting story. Fresh Express is recalling its organic market side spring mix. That's because two customers in Florida found a dead bat in their salad.
Wait! We can't stop here. This is bat country.
They were only sold at Walmart stores in the Southeast. That's us. But the question isn't, is that gross? It is. Yeah. But what is the worst thing you've ever found in a meal or a box of food?
Guess what? I found a small insect and precisely the same brand of a salad mix. That said, I usually don't shop for my veggies at Walmart. I shop at the farmer's market or at Aldi even, which is better. But that's the worst I've found, and it was precisely in the same product.
Well, it was really fresh. There was
Oh, my God.
It was alive. Thanks.
I've never actually found anything that I can recall that, you know, that is on that level of gross. I mean, you find, you know, hair here and there, maybe, but like an entire bat. I mean, a bat.
Yeah.
What is going on in Florida, for one? Because Florida has been messing up with all these crazy animals. Let's just, okay, we've all seen these videos of these crazy huge crocodiles and things, right? So what is really going on in Florida? So secondly, that is just, that's beyond gross. What is happening?
Okay, what nobody else has any gross stuff.
Dropped at the very moment the bag was being sealed, all right?
This is a perfect transition because the other question is what's happening at the White House press briefings? Not so much because of breaking news stories, but because of some unexpected comments that have occurred. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, earlier this week, at the start of Passover, addressed the use of chemical weapons by Syria's president, and while talking to reporters, he made this claim about Hitler.
We didn't use chemical weapons in World War II. You know, you had a, you know, someone as despicable as Hitler who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons.
That is patently false. Hitler gassed millions of people, his own people. But Spicer went on to describe concentration camps like this.
He brought him into to the Holocaust Center. I understand that.
Holocaust Center. Okay. Holocaust. Spicer has apologized for misspeaking. My question is, when is it misspeaking and when is it a fireable offense?
This is well past a fireable offense, I'd imagine. But he serves at the pleasure of the president, so he will be there. I did see a couple days ago a Republican congressman came out, publicly called for his resignation, said he wasn't serving the president well. I imagine you'll get many more calls like that very soon.
Yeah, he should be fired. I mean, the worst thing is that he's normalizing Hitler. And that's not a good direction for any culture, you know, any nation. But on top of that, he must have been a really poor student. This guy went to Connecticut College. Connecticut College is a decent school. I mean, if you don't know that, you shouldn't be a White House spokesman.
No, I doubt highly that he didn't know that. He knew about the Holocaust. He knows, I mean, at this point, this is common knowledge that you know all of the atrocities that went on. What this showed me was that he just did not care. He does not care. And when you don't care, you can hide it all you want, but when pressure comes on you, these things come out. So this is one of those things where he has to go. He had to go a while ago, but he really, really needs
She's
to go.
She's literally throwing up.
I have hand gestures out here right now.
He just is really a bad choice for the mouth of the White House. He's just not. I'm not even going to say that he was being purposefully anti-Semitic. I don't think that was his case. I just think he's not very brilliant.
Yeah,
I don't think
he's not. No, he's not. I agree. He doesn't care.
He's a bad communicator.
I would take it a step further, though. This is a post-fact White House. This guy got inaugurated and then sent his press secretary out to go say that this was the largest crowd for inauguration ever, right? Like, at some level, doesn't the administration have some responsibility to stop someone who takes the podium and who's purveying things that are clearly not facts?
Well, there's a detachment from reality.
Like when I watch him, we're watching an episode of Veep or something. Like it's surreal out here right now.
All right, we are. If you're just joining us, we're hanging out in the break room. We have Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez with us. Also, Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, and also Democratic strategist Howard Franklin and filmmaker and podcast producer Kalina Baller. Okay. We spoke a moment ago about the controversy in the White House press briefing room. Now let's talk about everyone's very fictional favorite political operative, Olivia Pope.
So you lost someone you loved. You lost the one person who felt like family. Well, guess what? Grow the hell up, because that is how it is.
Executives with ABC scandal, whew, have revealed that the network actually really pushed hard to get a white woman to play Olivia Pope on Scandal. And the question for me is, does the show's success now prove audiences are ready to see more people of color in starring roles?
Of course they're ready. I mean, they're not only ready, it's overdue. I mean, how many folks want to look at a TV, you know, environment where every single show looks like Mad Men? And
I always think you got to be careful when you see a black person break a barrier, because then the media jumps up and says, well, then now it's post-racial, right? And I don't know what America wants to see on its television, but I don't want to take one actress's or one president's success as this blanket acceptance of blacks in leadership roles on television, et cetera. I don't know that I agree that everyone wants to see it. I think it should be happening. My own personal viewpoint, I appreciate yours, Hector's, but I don't know that I think America is just, it looks at Olivia Pope and would want to see that done again.
I'm not saying all of America. Right, I'm just saying a sizable portion of America is already there.
Yeah, I think America is just ready to see good acting. And Kerry Washington's amazing. She's amazing.
All right, we can question that.
Okay, you know what? I have hand gestures
for you. Now it's
really going to throw down. No, I'm just saying. But this is something that audiences have been ready to see for quite some time. And I think that Hollywood executives have, you know, they default for what they know makes money. And for a long time, you know, it was just kind of intrinsic that, okay, you put these kinds of actors, these kinds of faces on screen and people will watch automatically because they're familiar. Well, now we're familiarizing more faces of color. And this is just the next step, and it's going to continue in this trend, in my opinion.
There's one sure way to find out. Try it again.
There you go.
All right. Speaking of that, let's talk about another viral video, shall we? There's a video of white people rapping about marijuana that's now been viewed by millions and millions of people. Here's a portion of that song.
I smoke Kush and I smoke purple. I move slow mo like a turtle.
I move slow mo like a turtle. When I smoke Kush and I smoke purple.
I smoke Kush and I smoke purple. I move slow mo.
Yeah, they have altered their voices. You can hear that as well. It shows people we assume are from Georgia, based on all of the Georgia gear they're wearing. And one man's actually rapping while wearing a Confederate flag vest, which some have called ironic. So, is this an appropriation of black culture, Kalina?
I think it's an appropriation of Migos culture. And that it sounds very much like the sounds of hip hop from the South that you're hearing now. I need a minute to collect my thoughts here.
Migos is a hip-hop group that from the early 2000s that formed actually in Lawrenceville. So
yes.
That's what you're talking
and
about.
And their latest album is named Culture, funny enough.
Yes.
That to say, hip-hop today, I mean, mainstream hip-hop today is already appropriated, right? It's hard to draw the line as to where, you know, it's representative of culture and where it came from. It's 40 years old now. It's no longer a baby art form. And I think, you know, as it grows, as it becomes more popular, more global, we have to accept some, maybe not accept, but expect some appropriation of the culture and speak out when we don't think it's appropriate. I think is what it comes
down to. Yeah, it's an art form at this point. So, it's going to be parodied and mocked.
That's right.
So.
These folks lack the cultural sophistication to go for parody. I mean, I don't think they're really aware of what they're doing. I mean, this is a pretty bad example.
There's a lot of appropriation going on in that particular video. It's great.
The most offended person is our libertarian. Who would think?
Oh my lord.
I'm thinking back to my great grandmother and how she always told us, you know, you're a southern gentleman, you're a southern lady, babe your way. And then I'm seeing this girl bouncing around talking about how she's a southern belle, and I can hear my grandmother, don't be so common. You're being common.
Oh, my Lord.
Quit being common. Quit talking about pot
Quit
and dancing around.
Quit being common.
Yeah, I think they just grabbed onto whatever is hot and viral at the time, at the moment. And that's what they did. And they're trying to get views, trying to get, you know.
They did get views.
Yeah,
all right. So let's talk about something else that's gotten millions of views. That's Atlanta's traffic. Already bad before the I-85 bridge collapsed. Even when that is repaired this summer, congestion problems are going to get worse. That is because, according to census data, more than 90,000 additional people have moved to the area within the past year, and we're going to get millions more in the years ahead. We could end up to be as crowded and dense a city as New York City, but without the subway system. So what's the tipping point? Is there a point at which the city becomes too crowded and you feel it's time to go?
The crowd is not the problem. I mean, the lack of subway is not the problem. The problem is whether the people in the crowd are going to be flexible and culturally tolerant of difference. I mean, if you have that sort of crowd...
When they're in their cars.
Well, the crowd, yeah. Well, that's a separate issue. That's the fact that Georgia drivers are Georgia drivers.
Or actually, Georgia drivers are drivers from everywhere else, which makes it very bad.
Exactly. But you know, the point is whether the crowd is going to be educated enough to be able to live together.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of an unfair comparison, New York to Atlanta. Yeah, Atlanta proper is just over 500,000 people in the city. We only get to that 6 million number when we take in another 8 or 9 or 12 counties. I think it's more like a metro Los Angeles to Atlanta. Another place has got terrible traffic and doesn't have much of a transit system.
Los Angeles has more of a transit system at this point.
That's
than we
true. They just made a big investment last year, and it's coming along. That to say, you know, I don't know that I'm not leaving Atlanta, first and foremost, to answer the question. And I hope that the people who decide to move here get better at driving or, to Hector's point, more tolerant in terms of other ways, other modes of transportation, biking, walking, transit, to the extent that it's available, particularly in the inner city.
It's going to happen. When 85 collapsed, we all of a sudden heard people who, I know that there are people who downed MARTA expansion and all of this, and suddenly they're like, oh, we need other modes of transportation. I said, well, you just said no to this thing. So, you know, it's going to happen. It's going to require a culture shift. It's going to require people really wanting to make a more comfortable way of living if you want to live within city limits or within that multi-county metro region. So
it's also going to be very dependent on resources.
Yeah. You know,
Atlanta is already talking about interbasin transfer for water, i.e. taking my water and bringing it to Atlanta from the Coosa River Basin or somewhere like that.
Well, Florida says we already took theirs.
And Florida and Alabama. And, you know, we can quickly find our way back into a water war that we're thinking we just won. Mm. But did we? Is it over? Can we produce the energy that we're going to need for Atlanta? Can we make the water? Other resources? More to a city than just packing people into a small space and trying to make them get along.
And I like to call, you know, Atlanta the kind of the show me what you got city. And I think that we can lead the way in innovation at this point. There's ways that we can, being in the South and being that we used to be a transportation hub for all kinds of commerce, I think this is going to be an opportunity for us to shine on a national scale. So this is going to be something going forward for the next 5 to 10 years that can really put us on the map even more.
All right, we have 1 minute, so I'm going to see how fast you guys can be. An Emory University student recently won $100,000. That student gave that money away to New School in Atlanta, which is a high school here, a private institution. Quickly, our rapid-fire responses. If you had $100,000 you didn't need, who would you give it to? Kalina?
You know what? I would give it to NICU hospitals.
Okay.
I'll give it to Historic Preservation.
I know Rostam, so congrats to him. And I would give it to my alma mater, Morehouse College.
And Hector.
Greenpeace, Amnesty International, Doctors Without Borders.
Okay, we're out of time in the break room. I want to say thank you to all my guests, Georgia State University Professor Hector Fernandez, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, and filmmaker and podcast producer Kalina Baller. You can answer that question for us as well. If you had $100,000 that for some reason you didn't need, who would you give that money to? Let us know. You know how to reach us at OST Talk on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook as well. For the day and for the week, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend.